This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. This morning and yesterday morning, I've seen beautiful flights of tundra swans flying west towards the Mississippi. And then after a stopover, they'll fly to the north coast of Alaska to join their western cousins for the breeding season. The sun was behind them, and with the wing beats, they would flash white on the underside. It was so beautiful. So I thought I would read Helen MacDonald today from her book, Vesper Flights. I hope you remember Helen MacDonald, author of H is for Hawk, which won many awards. And remember her book, F is for Falcon? She's a beautiful writer. Her last name is spelled MacDonald. Helen lives in England. This is the observatory. I never cared much for swans until the day a swan told me I was wrong. It was a cloudy winter morning, and I was suffering from a recently broken heart. I sat myself down on a concrete step by Jesus Lock and was staring at the river, feeling the world was just as cold and gray, when a female mute swan hoisted herself out of the water and stumped toward me on leathery, inturned, webbed feet and sturdy black legs. I assumed she wanted food. Swans can break an arm with one blow of their wing, I remembered, one of those warnings from childhood that get annealed into adult fight-or-flight responses. Part of me wanted to get up and move further away, but most of me was just too tired. I watched her, her snaky neck, black eye, her blank hauteur. I expected her to stop, but she did not. She walked right up to where I sat on the step, her head towering over mine. She then turned around to face the river, shifted left, and plonked herself down, her body parallel with my own, so close her wing feathers were pressed against my thighs. Let no one ever speak of swans as being airy, insubstantial things. I was sitting with something the size of a large dog, and now I was too astonished to be nervous. I didn't know what to do. I grasped, bewildered, for the correct interspecies social etiquette. She looked at me incuriously, and then tucked her head sideways and backwards into her raised coverts, neck curved, and fell fast asleep. We sat there together for 10 minutes, until a family came past and a toddler made a beeline for her. She slipped back into the water and plowed upstream. As I watched her leave, something shifted inside me, and I began to weep with an emotion I recognized as gratitude. That day was when swans turned into real creatures for me, and it has spurred me since to seek out others. My favorite place to see swans in winter is the Welney Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust Reserve. It's on the Ouse Washes, part of the highly engineered wetland landscape of the East Anglian Fens. The observatory here is far from the usual ramshackle wooden hide. It's heated and carpeted, and even has a glass case of taxidermied swans inside. Age has rendered them nicotine yellow, so they resemble the live birds outside the way smoked kippers resemble live herring. Just as unusual are the crowds sharing the observatory with me. There are a few wolfish-looking men with spectacular telescopes of a species common to nature reserves, but there are also impressively bouffanted ladies of a certain age peering through binoculars so elderly they resemble opera glasses. There's a woman in a wheelchair who sings joyously all the way down the bumpy slope to the door. There are teen goths and toddlers and couples in their 20s and 60s and 80s, and a baby in pink tights and a glittery top. All of us, apart from the baby, who is transfixed by the goths, are looking out of the panoramic plate glass windows across a mile of water, broken by tiny islands and dotted lines that are the stalks of drowned grass and huddles of sleeping black-tailed godwits. There are no shadows anywhere out there, except in the moving lines between ripples that chase themselves across miles of shallow water. As the light diminishes, distant structures become unmoored and float on the horizon. trees, pylons, wind turbines. Closer, willows are frozen like ice on glass. The lake is mercury bright and patterned with thousands of birds as far as the eye can see, moving dots of mallard, widgeon, pochard, and miniature bergs that are swans. A lake the size of Loch Lomond appears here every winter and drains to wet pasture in spring. Famed for wild fowling and winter skating, it's become a traditional wintering site for thousands of swans that come to feast on potatoes left in the ground after harvest, on sugar beet, on winter wheat. These aren't the familiar mute swans of town parks and lakes, not the species that came up to me and made its presence known. They're whooper swans and bewick's swans, birds that breed in Arctic Iceland and Siberia, and they are very different beasts. Whoopers cross the North Atlantic nonstop to get here, flying for 12 hours at around 20,000 feet through icy and oxygen-poor air. They're huge and impressive creatures, but it's the smaller species here, the bewick swans, that are the favorite of WWT Warden Sean, who has come into the observatory to talk with us before the evening feed. Sean is a stockman of sorts. In summer, he looks after cattle that graze on the washes. When it's flooded, he looks after the swans. Quote, "The yellow from their beaks continues up and around their eyes," he says reverently of his bewicks. "Like yellow eyeliner, they're such pretty little birds." Near the case of swans in this observatory, there's a bronze bust of the WWT's founder, Sir Peter Scott. He loved them too. 50 years ago, he noticed that every swan had a different pattern of yellow and black on its bill. Fascinated, he started to name them and paint tiny swan reference mugshots of each bird. This developed into a Facebook, a visual catalog of individual swans that has continued today. Even now, WWT researchers memorize birds by sight, and Scott's initial tracing of swans and their family trees has become one of the longest-running wildlife studies in the world. In conjunction with radio tracking and ringing studies, the data it produces is crucial for conservation. While whooper populations are healthy, bewicks are not. Climate and habitat change seem likely factors in their rapid decline. When I was small, bewick's swans were strange and glamorous because they migrated here from the Soviet Union, crossing the Iron Curtain with absolute unconcern. I've often wondered what lay behind Peter Scott's fascination with them. To an ex-naval officer, explorer's son, and champion glider pilot, the heroic North Sea flights of whoopers would certainly appeal, but it's tempting to imagine that a particular strand of English conservatism influenced his desire to individuate bewick's swans, to turn them into families rather than flocks, trace their family trees and give them names like Cassino, Croupier, Lancelot, Jane Eyre, and Victoria before they returned to the Soviet Union each spring. Politics are so easily caught up in science. The Cold War unwittingly pleated into swans' rushing, beating wings. Now the floodlights are switched on and the water shivers. There's a hush of anticipation as Sean leaves the observatory and reappears pushing a wheelbarrow along the shoreline, casting great scoopfuls of corn into the lake. We crowd to the window. A raft of winter wildfowl is feeding busily beneath us. Conker-headed pochards, mallards, scores of whoopers and bewicks with cloudy pinions and snowy necks. These birds are entirely wild, yet here they are, tame as farmyard ducks, feeding on a wet stage lit up like a West End theater. The experience is joyous, but messes with your everyday notions of what a wild animal is, what wildness is at all. But something is missing. I'm chasing something like the feeling the Cambridge swan had given me, and it isn't there. Though I have an intimation of where I might find it. Leaving the observatory, I head for the old wooden hides next door, raise a narrow window, and let in the soundscape outside. What do thousands of Arctic swans sound like? A vast amateur brass band tuning up in an aircraft hangar. My heart soars. Every few seconds comes a carillon of new voices. The swans are coming home to roost in little family groups, silhouettes that rise over the observatory and plane down to the black water. They are calling to each other in the night, these beautiful migrants, some of their faces stained yellow, some dark with potato mud, their broad webbed feet splayed to break as they descend. They land, call, flap their wings, squabble, dip their heads under the water, preen, drink thirstily. This is why I came. It's impossible to regard the natural world without seeing something of our own caught up in it. Back on that wintry riverside, a swan had come towards me and offered me strange companionship at a time when I thought loneliness was all I could feel. And what comforts me now, watching these Arctic swans in our era of rising political nativism, is how clearly they are at home. And that's her essay called Observatory. I'm reading from Helen MacDonald's book, Vesper Flights, a collection of essays, published in 2020. And one more. This one's called Eulogy. By 9, the sun has set behind the King's Forest. The sky is a soft Tiffany blue, darker above us, and there's not a breath of wind. Judith knows the place well, leads us through deep woodland to a few acres of open land, a block of head-height young pines growing through grass and brambles, surrounded by walls of mature trees. We're waiting for something that won't happen until the light is nearly gone, so we amble for a while along the sandy paths. As night falls, our senses stretch to meet it. A roebuck barks in the distance. Small mammals rustle in the grass. The faintest tick of insects, the scratchy, resinous fragrance of heathland grows stronger, more insistent. As we pass clumps of vipers' bugloss, we watch the oncoming night turn their leaves blacker, their purple petals bluer and more intense until they seem to glow. The paths become luminous trails through darkness. White moths spiral up from the ground, and a cockchafer zips past us, elytra raised, wings buzzing. Soon all color will be gone. The thought is a hard one. Over the last few weeks, I spent much of my time visiting Stu in a local hospice. He and his partner, Mandy, are among my dearest, closest friends. I first met him in the 1990s on a raw December morning at a falconry field meet in the East Anglian Fens. He was a giant of a man with curly hair and a huge old goshawk, and he was formidable and faintly scary. But as I watched him handle his hawk and his dogs, I saw there an extraordinary gentleness and care. So many of my memories of Stu are of his gentleness, the way he'd look at his family, the expression on his upturned face as he followed his falcon's flight, the tender way he'd clean their hooked beaks between finger and thumb. He was a strong man, a strong-willed man, who carved his own inimitable path through life, and he had an astonishing capacity to reassure, to teach, to inspire. Stu was so ready to see magic in the world. He told me once, shaking his head in wonderment, that he'd watched a white stag stepping across the road at midnight like something out of a medieval legend. About the time he caught a bat in his motorcycle leathers while biking at top speed, and how he was so amazed and delighted, he put it in his pocket and brought it home to show everyone before letting it go. And how, after he had been diagnosed with the illness that he knew would take him, he'd been walking with his pointer dog, Cody, across fields when she'd found two just-born leverets, twin baby hares, tucked in the grass. Stuart was the strongest of men, but he told me about them with tears in his eyes. They were so small, so new. Now watching the slow diminishment of sense and detail around me, I'm thinking of Stu and what is happening to him, thinking of his family, of what we face at the end of our lives, long summers, when the world parts from us, of how we all one day will walk into darkness. Then the sound begins. It spools out from the trees behind the sapling pines, and I catch the flash of a smile on Judith's face in the gloom. The noise resembles a sewing machine running at top speed or an unspooling fishing reel, but such mechanical analogies fail to capture its rich musicality. It's a deep and beautiful churring that lasts for 4 or 5 seconds before the creature that's making it breathes in briefly, lowering the pitch, and then starts up again. Judith cups a hand behind each ear and turns her head to pinpoint the source. She gestures out in front of us, a little to our left. Somewhere in that direction, sitting lengthways on a branch, his throat puffed out to raise this strange song to the night, is a nightjar. Imagine a slim bird, as long as your hand from wrist to fingertip, and with huge black ink anime eyes. Imagine its plumage is patterned with all woodland things rolled together, bark, rotting wood, the tips of dry fern fronds, cobwebs, the bright ends of broken twigs, dappled shadows, dead leaves. Nightjars are cryptic beasts for whom subtlety is safety. During daylight hours, they rest and nest upon the ground that so perfectly matches their feathers, they are almost impossible to detect, even from a few feet away. Their neat beaks look ordinary enough until they open their mouths into a huge, frog-like pink gape surrounded by bristly feathers that help them catch their flying prey, moths, beetles, other insects. The bird we're hearing spent his winter in Africa and has come here to mate and rear young in this checkerboard landscape of coniferous forest and heath before he heads back south in late August or September. Another chirr begins, and then another. 5 birds? 6? It's hard to tell, but they're calling all around us. It's exquisite music, but I'm hoping we get something more. We do. There's a soft call, a different call, the one they make in flight. I whistle something like it back into the darkness. The call comes again, closer now, and as I strain my eyes into the noisy black, I see the barest suggestion of a bird flying towards me, wings as thin, wavering lines appearing and disappearing over the distance between the noise and my upturned face, and then sailing out just above our heads, dark against the sky, is a nightjar. It's remarkably odd, the shape of a skinny falcon, but somehow the quality of its flight makes it look like a paper aeroplane. It's so light in the air it seems to have no weight at all, and there's something moth-like about it, too. I can just make out the barring of the underside of its wings, the lack of white near the tips. It's a female. And we watch as she hunches herself in midair, curls down to the left, and hovers briefly. A male joins her, white wing patches blurring. They circle for a few seconds before breaking apart and disappearing into the darkness. We hear a quick, flat, clapping noise as the male slaps the top of his wings together in flight, a display that sounds like quiet applause. And then they are gone, slipping back into the nothing around us. For years, on and off, I have woken in the dark, shouting out loud, stricken with horror at the impossible fact of death. It has been my most abiding and paralyzing terror, but it was Stu who banished it from me. At the hospice, he looked me in the eye very seriously, very quietly, and said of what was happening to him, "It's okay. It's okay." I knew it was not, that what he was doing was reassuring me, and it was an act of such generosity that for a while I couldn't find anything strong enough inside me to reply. "It's okay," he said. "It's not hard." Those are the words I'm remembering as we walk onward, as the minutes pass, until night thickens completely, and there is starlight and dust and the feel of sand underfoot. It's so dark now, I cannot see myself. But the song continues, and the air around us is full of invisible wings. And that's the end of her essay called Eulogy. This is Helen MacDonald I'm reading from her book Vesper Flights. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.